Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, John Edwards' first love child, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
I always liked John Edwards' smile. He had a smile.
He's a good-looking man.
He is a good. When he used to be on like Bill Maher or something, and he'd look at you, I would just kind of say, John, take my wallet, shake it upside down, take all my money, and give it away to people, because you look like a good guy. I was kind of wrong.
Do you think it's true that good-looking men are more likely to cheat than not good-looking men?
A cheat at golf, a car,
on their women, on their wives.
Well, you said kind of cheat generally. I don't know. They probably get more opportunities.
Well, right.
Is there a rigorous, scientifically verified body of research on this?
I just wonder. I don't know. Maybe Amber could do a research minute on this one day.
Evolutionary psychology. They do stuff like this.
They do. They will. Yeah. Although, but they don't actually. Then can't actually figure out who cheats, because that's a whole different ball game.
But see, that's assuming that. But this is assuming that all men would cheat if they had the opportunity, and that's not a fair assumption.
No, certainly sex addicts would.
Right. And they could be ugly or good-looking.
Well, but if they're good-looking, they probably have an easier time. And if you're Tiger, if you're rich and good-looking, probably much easier to be.
So basically, the whole Tiger thing was inevitable. I mean, that was right.
That's like being
good-looking, rich, and it turns out a sex addict.
It's like being a sugar addict who owns your own Baskin Robbins. There was just. He would have been better shape if he was like less good looking and had less money.
All right. Well, our listeners came here to listen to us talk about education, or so we think. So we should do that. We've got a lot on deck today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute, and Stafford is going to rate that reform. Mickey, bring your A game today, baby. Let's get started. Right. Pardon the Gadfly.
The Department of Education will not release the names of the reviewers of the Race to the Top until after the competition is over. What's up with this secret panel?
Ooh. You know, I think Duncan is deeply concerned that states are going to start throwing fruit baskets at these guys, or else maybe New Jersey's going to put out. I have no idea what he's thinking. It strikes me that after the president pledged, unprecedented transparency, after Duncan's been out front talking about how he is going to ensure that this is a credible and transparent process, to then kind of say, well, even though it's a novel contest with a somewhat ambiguous criteria on 19 priorities and sometimes conflicting guidance, we want you to just trust us. It strikes me as nuts.
Yeah, it is nuts, and Rick's been all over this on the blogosphere, loving it. Not waiting for his debut as an EdWeek blogger.
Ooh, but I'm excited, baby.
But you're excited.
So what exactly would we gain by knowing the names of the reviewers while the review is going on?
Wait. Is that a follow-up question from Mickey?
Mick, you told him to bring his A-game.
I was going to say.
He's throwing it off. Look, you know. I mean, first thing to keep in mind is that this just shows how difficult this was. And Mike, when you and Andy Rotherham were jousting about this a little bit about a year ago, and you raised some concerns about the structure of the, you know, Andy and Sarah Mead's proposal at that point for federal intervention and innovation, Andy's general reply was that, well, look, there'd been Bush-era mistakes on, say, reading first, but these were preventable, and the fact that the Bushies had got it wrong didn't mean everybody would get it wrong.
Yeah.
I think this shows just how fraught the minefield is.
Yep.
Look, there's questions about what constitutes conflict of interest, which if we know the reviewers, people can vet this, people can raise issues in advance rather than after the cake's been baked. We can actually get a sense of how impressive or not impressive these 58 superstar, intellectual superstars, I think Duncan called them, or education superstars really are, if we know who they are.
But look, there's a much better reason to do this, and it's to protect Duncan, okay? What's going to happen is at the end of the day, there's going to be enormous pressure for Duncan to make these decisions politically, all right? The White House is going to realize that all the money is going to go to Republican states, for example, and they're going to say, whoa. Or that Ted Strickland in Ohio has a tough election campaign, and he's not going to get the money, and they're going to say, whoa. if you make everything transparent, you put out, you know, first of all, make sure that all of the applications are available publicly. Everybody knows who the reviewers are. Everybody knows exactly what the process is. Then, you know, us think tankers will look at these applications. We'll be able to say, hey, everybody will know which of these states are most deserving of the money. And if some bizarre state that's in the middle of the pack gets funded, it'll be obvious to everyone that something funny has gone on. That will keep Duncan, that'll allow Duncan to be able to say no to Rahm Emanuel when he says, next September, October, hey, you got to get Ohio some of this money. If we all are able to say, and we all know that Ohio, for example, is nowhere to be seen, that protects them. And I think the more information you put out there, the more transparent, the less pressure there will be. Because look, at the end of the day, the Department of Education rules say all of this is discretionary. These review panels are just advisors. The secretary can give this money to anybody he wants, legally. But he doesn't want to have that discretion, I promise you, because the White House people will push him to do things that he doesn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Next question.
Mike.
Bam, bam, bam.
Boom, baby.
In his State of the Union address yesterday, President Obama proposed a 3-year discretionary freeze on federal spending outside of national security. How is this going to affect education?
Okay, but before we get into that, Mike, let's just point out that, look, we're talking here about minuscule dollars, right? We're talking about $15 billion saved this year. Meanwhile, the Senate is this week putting the touches on an $80 billion infusion with $30 billion to save state and local jobs. So, first off, this doesn't mean anything. This is pointless, ceaseless window dressing, the kind of stuff which has been far too familiar the last year.
Well, look, the president can propose anything he wants. You know, Congress is going to do what they're going to do. And unless he's willing to veto some of these spending bills, which even George W. Bush was not willing to do.
Even, I mean, let's be honest here. Bush was an embarrassment, a debacle, and a millstone for the Republicans on questions of fiscal responsibility.
That's absolutely true. I mean, so it's the same thing as, you know, Obama proposes, we're going to get rid of earmarks, and then they don't. So it sounds like from what we can tell that the education will be spared, that the education will continue to see increases. But if he is saying that overall we're going to freeze the spending over the long term, I think it does show that the intention is not to keep the education increases going up at a dramatic clip as has happened in the past.
Although, you know, the problem right here is I don't feel like one can really believe anything Obama's saying at this particular moment. The very week he announces a discretionary freeze, he announces 5 new spending initiatives, none of which have price tags attached. Last week he announced another $1.3 billion for Race to the Top. It's not clear, they haven't proposed a single offsetting cut if they're going to actually have this flexible discretionary freeze.
This stuff is, he's previewing the budget. The budget had to get baked weeks, if not months ago. These things take forever. So when the budget comes
cut,
out,
Mike, where do you actually expect Obama to come up with the cut, with the offsetting cuts?
It'll be in these agencies we've never heard of, on stuff that nobody cares about.
Right.
And Congress won't go along with it. They'll propose to cut earmarks, or they'll, you know, subsidies to the student loan program or whatever. And they may not.
You know, I mean, my take on the discretionary freeze is real simple. First rule of holes is when you're in one, you stop digging. I'd like him to put the shovel down, just for starters.
Okay. Mickey, all right. Time for you to pick up your shovel and start digging.
Okay, let me dig you into a fascinating question about the future of education policy. All right. Education sector, New America Foundation, and a handful of other left-of-center education policy organizations are currently looking to fill senior or executive roles. Who would you like to see fill these voids? And what would you like to see from the next generation of left-of-center education policy leaders?
2 quick thoughts. First, this is probably about the most navel-gazing question we've ever dealt with. Again, so it's okay.
It's a slow news week, I guess.
2, Mike, I think you'd be a terrific fit for either of these. I don't think people recognize how left-of-center you are. And you, my friend, would make a terrific participant in the next generation of
thanks,
center.
Thanks, Rick. But I know that you're just trying to throw me under the bus here, saying I've gone left. Look, the more interesting point here is this. First of all, when all of a sudden were there so many of these left-of-center education groups, and do we need them all? I mean, okay, let's count them here. Okay, Center on Education Policy, right? Mm-hmm. Left of center, Jack Jennings is leaving. Mm-hmm. And many people thought, look, this was Jack Jennings' group. Do we still need it? I don't know. Education sector, everybody thought this was sort of Andy Rotherham's group, he and Tom Talk. Neither one of them going to be there anymore, right? What happens there? New America Foundation, has a big education group, 7 or 8 people over there. So there's another one. There's, you know, don't forget, there's also Aspen. There's the Center on American Progress. There's
Brookings.
Brookings. There's a lot of these groups out there. Now, I don't want to sound like sour grapes. People would say, well, same on the right. But let's, I don't know. There's basically Fordham, and there's Rick. And who else?
Well, I think people would throw in there, they'd throw in Cato and Heritage and Center for Ed Reform.
Yes. But those groups, I mean, just like, it's like Heritage and Cato, we're talking about, you know, maybe one or two people. I mean, these are not big shops doing lots of stuff. On the left, we're talking about many organizations. We're talking about 6, 7, 8
Ed
people,
Trust.
Millions of dollars, lots of grant money. I'll just be curious. I think there's going to be some mergers coming down the pike because I don't see how all of these groups can be sustainable.
I want to see a couple of hostile mergers there. Wouldn't that be something to watch?
Well, that would be fun. Hostile takeovers?
I want to see
Should we take over any of these groups? I'm serious. Which one should we pick?
I want to see Aspen go pick off, say, EdSec or CEP. That would be that would be one of those battle royales.
Yeah.
Amber, how do you feel? You looking for a job at a left to center think tank?
Not really, but can I tell you, I do have people calling me here wanting to take me away.
Let's not talk about your social life on the air, Amber.
Yes. All right, it's time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. But back to that again, Rick. I do like this idea. Introducing the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's new Center on Education Policy.
I like it. And they're affiliated at Education Sector.
Ba-boom.
I like it.
This is part of the, you know, when this conservative tide washes the country this fall, we'll just...
This is kind of the Gates Foundation equivalent. They just go out and kind of snatch up all the talent.
Yeah.
You guys could just go cherry pick.
Well, by the way, speaking of Gates, I mean, what would, if tomorrow Bill Gates decided that he was done with education... and he's going to go fund environment instead? I mean, I don't know. Like, all of our friends would be out of jobs, as far as I can tell. It would be catastrophic to the Washington education policy scene. Okay, sorry, Amber. What are we talking
about
today?
All right. This week we have a new report called The High Cost of Low Educational Performance. It's commissioned by OECD and authored by Stanford economist Eric Hanischek and colleagues. It builds on Eric's prior work and shows that improved performance on international math and science tests has a positive impact on a country's future economic health, as measured by a nation's gross domestic product. Researchers used data from 12 international tests, including PISA, dating back from 1964, to construct an index of cognitive skills for a large sample of countries. All right, in a nutshell, he gives three scenarios. Scenario one is if we increase our average scores on PISA by 25 points over 20 years, it will result in an increase of U.S. GDP of $40 trillion over the lifetime of the generation born in 2010. The second scenario, bring each country to the average level of Finland, which is the highest performing country. That would increase our GDP by $100 trillion over the same length of time. Third scenario, let's see if we raise the scores of U.S. children who already perform below acceptable levels on PISA. That's about 19% of kids. If we do that, we'd add $70 trillion to our GDP over the same time period. So the projections are just that. He goes through a wide variety of sort of additional tests to assess the validity and so on and so forth. Really wonky report, but that's the bottom line.
So AMS, I mean, what's the response to folks who say, well, gee, that sounds interesting, but aren't there a bunch of other causal factors going on, and how do you tease those apart from change in education?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, he went through, you know, all these other things that could possibly, you know, be occurring here, and kind of gives a list of potential things that could be occurring. You know, I mean, I think bottom line for me, like, everybody loves this stuff. I mean, what's there, you know, what country wouldn't like to hear, you know, your kids do better on math and science test and you're going to increase your economic well-being? I mean, there's nothing, you know, just nothing that's really to say here.
So here's my big question is, so he goes back and he'll say that, okay, take a country, I suspect, like South Korea, that made these gains on international tests over this time, and then look how much their economy grew over that time. But isn't it possible that the causation goes in the other direction? Mm-hmm. I mean, that South Korea got a lot wealthier over time, and as a result, its kids are doing a lot better.
Right, and
tests.
He talks about reverse causation and the likelihood of reverse causation. And then he says, you know, even if you want to really minimize these projections, even if you just don't believe a lot of this is happening, so half, you know, just cut it in half. And he's like, still, it's substantial growth, you know, and it would have an impact. So, I mean, he's saying, you know, if you assume that these are overinflated or even, you know, whatnot, that you know, that there's still a difference, a significant difference to be made here.
Yeah, you know, part of what this goes to, though, is, right, I mean, Rick's bedrock assumption is still the economist's assumption that education is teaching people these skills and knowledge that makes them more economically productive. Mm-hmm. I mean, another argument here is that there's kind of a queuing effect that's signaling that more education either reflects new opportunities in the labor market, in the job market, or that these people get jobs which are more lucrative, so international, there's a whole bunch of other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing he did look at in addition was years of schooling, you know, and did, you know, was able to control for that and say pretty definitively that, you know, it's not the amount of time that you're in school, it's the quality of that schooling. So yeah, I mean, this was an EdNext article he'd done not too long ago that I think he just kind of took it another step in terms of the projections and doing the projections by country and that sort of thing. But the methodology was very similar to what he did before.
Okay, so what is the song that goes
along
with this?
So the song is, since we're talking about amping up the skills of our workforce, we have Working on a Dream by Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
He played that at the Super Bowl. Was it last year? I think 2 years ago.
Rick, you take me as the kind of guy who'd be a big Bruce Springsteen fan.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I expect you kind of watch his music videos on that large kind of knock 'em down TV that's in your closet.
Right. Hey, by the way, do you notice that I seem much perkier this week?
Why is it?
I got a good night's sleep last night.
I thought I didn't want to ask because I thought it might be pharmaceuticals.
Oh, well, yeah.
Why'd you get a good night's sleep?
I just the baby slept, and I kind of, my wife let me take go to sleep early, and I took the later night shift. Anyways, the bottom line is the baby slept pretty well.
Oh, yay! Yeah.
So shout out to Leandro. Thank you, letting me get some sleep.
Is he listening to the podcast?
Probably. I make him listen already. Yeah.
But you don't listen.
So slight complication.
Okay.
All right, Stafford. It is time for Stafford's Rate That Reform. I have made my other son, Nico, who just turned two, watch me on television a couple times I've been on TV. And, you know, you would think he'd be, like, wowed by this. And he really didn't seem that phased at all.
You think your son watched you on TV?
I thought it would be a special, special treat.
Was one of those the time that they put some scary makeup on one of our friends?
You mean when my face was painted like an American flag?
No, never.
That was just Fordham TV. That wasn't real TV.
Oh, it all blurs.
Okay.
All right.
I think Stafford, it's time to rate that reform. Rate that
Yeah.
Brown bear, what do you see? That is what Bill Martin Jr., author of this well-known children's book, would like to know. The answer apparently is worker unity and a revolution of the proletariat. The Texas State Board of Education has banned this classic picture book because Bill Martin Jr. is apparently a secret socialist. Or put another way, in 2008, Brown Bear went red. When Martin authored another tome, this one sadly with no pictures, called Ethical Marxism, the Categorical Imperative of Liberation. What does Brown Bear see? An iron fist.
It would have sold better if he called it Pinko Bear.
Now see, if Texas board member Terry Leo, who proposed this change, had done her research, she would have realized that there are two Bill Martins, and the one who wrote Brown Bear not only died in 2004, 4 years before the publication of this treatise on Marxism, but had never written anything more controversial than a book on how to say the Pledge of Allegiance for little kids. Bill Martin, the Marxist, however, is a professor of philosophy at DePaul University. Sharing a name, though, is enough to get you nicks from reading lists, as poor Bill Martin, may he rest in peace, discovered when Leo expressed her concern that Martin had written adult content with, quote, very strong critiques of capitalism and the American system, end quote. It's not rocket science to know that I'm going to give this an F, but I will defer to Michael Sampson, who has co-authored 30 children's books with Bill Brown Bear Martin, to explain. This is a, quote, new low for, quote, faulty research and making such a false leap without substantiation. Amen.
What was the reform?
It's the Texas School Board, Texas State School Board. You gotta love this. School Board
not doing its research, banning a children's
book. Hold on. Even if it was the same Bill Martin, right? Even if. I mean, who cares? I mean, unless you're like, oh, I reinterpret this. But banning books? What are we doing? It's 2010. We're still banning books?
Unclear.
They ban books in Texas still?
Of course, it's Texas.
Right. They ban really? A lot of books.
I don't think
people ban a lot of books. We ban books left, right? We.
I don't think the proposal has passed yet. So it was a proposal to ban the book.
Kids stay up till 9 o'clock at night. They can watch The Situation try to hook up on Jersey Shore. Right? Kids stay up till 10 o'clock. You could see random nudity on like Showtime, but God forbid, kid read these things. It's insane.
You know they're gonna do a second season of Jersey Shore.
I heard that The Situation, I think, and Snooki were getting it on a little bit, huh? In the last,
yeah,
is that
in the hot tub?
I've seen it. I'm just saying. So this, kids are swimming in this, and we spent a ton of time worrying about trivial nonsense.
Brown bear, what do you see? I see a screwed up education system looking at me. Okay, and with that, that's all the time we got. By the way, I do like the Brown Bear book. It's a very it's nice
great.
Book. It's very
it's great.
Yeah. Illustrated by Eric Carle.
Yes, very
same
talented.
Guy who did the caterpillar.
Ironically, book. Brown Bear actually sees a red bird. I don't know if Bill Martin planned this out 4 years down the line for his... write a book on Marxism.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all the time we got. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show. Always available at edexcellence.net. Signing off.